Welcome to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Natasha Moore. Today on Life and Faith, we're thinking about a topic that sounds a bit abstract, but that really goes to the heart of what we think we're here for as humans and how we can live lives that are satisfying and useful, lives that make the world a better place. Last week, we talked about poverty and luxury and the effective altruism movement, the ethical dilemmas that are posed by the huge amount of suffering that there is in the world, and how much we, with our limited understanding and resources, can expect to do to change that. This week, we're continuing that conversation, but thinking specifically about beauty and culture. Is it frivolous and cruel to build a museum when you could feed so many starving people with the money that that costs? Or how about throwing a party? How about spending time writing poetry or playing cricket? These are questions that I found myself asking when I went to see a film recently, a documentary called The First Monday in May. So it goes behind the scenes of the Met Gala in New York and what it looks like to organise maybe the world's most glamorous party.
The Met Ball is the Super Bowl of social fashion events.
Ah! Wow!
Got a party tonight!
I think fashion should be recognised.
What's up, Met Ball?
When it touches people and moves people. I mean, what more can you ask from art?
The First Monday in May is a fascinating film about this very opulent world of art and fashion and celebrity. And watching it, you feel kind of torn, or I felt kind of torn, between feeling how beautiful and glamorous and I'm glad this kind of thing exists, you know, this art and beauty and pleasure, even if I, an ordinary schmo, will never ever be part of something like this. But also feeling like it's all a bit obscene. Like, how does anyone justify the expense and the human dedication that goes into this fashion exhibition and this big social do? Once again, I have Simon Smart and John Dixon here, and we're going to try to make some headway on this ethical dilemma of art versus material needs, or beauty, if you will, versus function. Last week, we quoted a person who wrote on our Facebook wall in response to a podcast that we did on this new museum opening in DC, the Museum of the Bible. They wrote,
"Surely it is better to spend the time, money, and energy required for this project on putting what Jesus said into practice. What about feeding the homeless on the streets of DC?"
John, how would you answer that person? How can anyone justify spending $400 million on a museum when people are starving and homeless?
It depends if it's a good to highlight the Bible. If it's not a good, like a grand good, then of course you shouldn't. I mean, the argument makes sense, but the assumption behind the argument is it's not good to highlight the Bible's inspiration for Western culture, which is what that Bible museum is about. And if we decide it is a grand good to highlight the Bible's influence, ongoing influence, then it's surely worth $400 million more, and especially since it is in fact the influence of the Bible that has created this charity culture that the West has at the center.
Is it kind of about ranking goods? How do we go about ranking things?
I don't think you can. I don't think you can mathematically rank goods. There are certain things that are highlighted as great goods for the Christian. This is right, and they will include care for the poor as a theme that's throughout Scripture, Old and New Testament. But then the arts are highlighted as goods. Creativity is highlighted as a good. Joy and pleasure and banqueting and friendship are highlighted as goods. And I would say that if you have to deny those other goods in order to pursue one good, that is care for the poor, then it's not a full-orbed Christian view of life. But I would much rather say, let's do both. Let's spend $400 million on highlighting the Bible, especially as the Bible's so terrifically influential and inspirational for all of life. But let's also spend more than that, as in fact we do, on aid work. I mean, $400 million is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket of charity work in the US.
Yeah, and the museum does look pretty cool, actually.
There'd be somewhere, though, there's a line somewhere where it would drift over, wouldn't it, into obscene?
Probably, but it's obviously hard to work out. And I don't think you can make ethical decisions based on the sort of the polarities here. It's a little more art than science. But I would just affirm that it's about judging what the goods are and not denying goods for the sake of another good.
There's a specific question here about, you know, art and beauty. I once had this quite heated conversation with a scientist. So I was doing my PhD in literature at the time. And he explained to me that we shouldn't even have the humanities, that if everybody devoted their resources to curing cancer, I think was the example he used, we'd arrive at a solution far more quickly. So why are we, or his point was, why was I, wasting time on things like poetry?
Yeah,
Simon.
Fair enough too, I'd say.
And I can imagine sure, I see your point.
It wasn't the most civil of conversations.
No, you're talking to somewhat of a philistine there, surely. I mean, this is, if you took that sort of logic, you'd never sit with a small child and read them a beautiful story.
Even have a child. If you really took this seriously, you'd go, hang on, every kid's going to cost me $200,000 by the time I kick him out of the house, so I should save that $200,000 and give it to World Vision. There you go.
Exactly. So, and the wonder of music and art and literature, perhaps not, you know, resonating with your friend, but for many of us, those things are rich, the richness of what it is to be human. And it's a scary logic that starts to want to deny those things in favour of some supposed other good.
The only good that's operating for this person or that whole argument is survival, which is unsurprising since probably survival of the fittest is, you know, in the background here. But that isn't the Christian calling. Survival isn't the calling. Flourishing for all that we are meant to be. See, Christians do believe that human beings are called to a number of great ends, and survival isn't the end. There are many other ends. And so it's a reductionist view.
Now, I happen to have had a conversation, a conversation with the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, about this very topic recently when we were talking to him about
our
documentary. So why not pull that out of my back pocket and hear what he said in answer to that type of question about beauty and whether that has any usefulness.
The whole idea that it's worth spending time and money and putting resource into the arts is not very popular in or out of universities. It reflects an idea that our primary job as human beings is problem solving. We need all the time to increase our capacity to solve problems. So we need to increase our technological reach, our scientific exactitude, because all problems reduce to problems of managing the stuff around us. And that sounds very simple until you realize that, of course, no actual human being works in that way, and that the problems that are most resistant to solution are problems for which you need not information but imagination. So we have to nurture in ourselves that capacity to see ourselves from a different perspective, to see our human world through the eyes of others. We have to develop, in the broadest sense, an empathic understanding of our world and our neighbours, and that is what the arts and the humanities do. So to suppose that the only worthy recipient of human energy, public money, and all those other things is technology-oriented science, is really to shrink what we think about human capacity pretty radically. So I think part of what a religious presence in culture today needs to be about is challenging what we think about knowledge, what we think about the intellectual life, helping us to see that the very word intellectual, which causes lots of people to come out in spots, is really about the imaginative as well as the intelligent engagement with the wholeness of our world.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. That was Rowan Williams talking about art and beauty and the purpose of the humanities. I really wish I'd had him on hand when I was having this argument with a scientist about why I was bothering to study literature. Well, we've been thinking in this two-part episode about some of the complexities of altruism and charity and culture and how we spend our money and our time. To finish off this discussion, we thought we'd look at a story that encapsulates in just a few sentences a bunch of these issues and questions. It's a story about Jesus and a woman who does something unexpected at a dinner party that he's at.
While Jesus was in Bethany in the home of Simon the leper, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very expensive perfume, which she poured on his head as he was reclining at the table. When the disciples saw this, they were indignant. Why this waste? They asked. This perfume could have been sold at a high price and the money given to the poor. Aware of this, Jesus said to them, Why are you bothering this woman? She has done a beautiful thing for me. The poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. When she poured this perfume on my body, she did it to prepare me for burial. Truly I tell you, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her.
Jesus' disciples ask the same question that we've been looking at. They look at this gesture where this perfume was worth maybe a year's wages, and they kind of go, how can we justify the wastefulness of buying expensive things or of beautiful gestures like this when we could do something much more pragmatic and look after the people who are most desperate? John, do you think that this old story has some wisdom for us as we wrestle with these questions?
Well, I don't want to reach in and find too many sort of practical references for our podcast because it's not what the text is for. The text is clearly pointing toward Jesus' journey to Jerusalem and this, the way this woman, even without knowing it, has anointed him for burial because he's going to his death. But the principle that is in the story is that there are goods that aren't simply caring for the poor that we can be lavish toward. And so that is a principle that you do find in Old and New Testament. In the Old Testament, you know, the lavishness of people's gifts to build the temple, it would be one example. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul says, God has given us, in speaking to the rich in particular, in 1 Timothy, he says, God has given us all good things for our enjoyment. Command the rich to be rich in good deeds and willing to share. In other words, the rich are allowed to richly enjoy the benefits of bounty and creation because that's a good. It's something for which we are created, but they must do it with a consciousness of the poor. And I don't think Jesus is saying to the disciples, hey, the poor don't matter compared to me, da, da, da. But he does say that the poor will always be with you. And this is virtually a quotation from a passage in the Old Testament that says, because the poor will always be with you, you must be open-handed toward them. And so in context, people wouldn't have heard it as the poor don't matter. He's saying the poor will always be with you and you'll have many opportunities as you should to open your hand to them. But there is something very profound. There is a great good right here, right now, that is worth lavishing with your love. And so I think I can, you know, comfortably extend that to the kind of, to look for other goods in human culture where we can be lavish because they are goods. And when you lavish things, you signify their meaning and importance. In fact, as you know, I just spent a few months in the glorious and lavish buildings of Oxford University where I was pursuing a research project. And, you know, every day I got to sit in the Bodleian, this extraordinary ancient library, the Duke Humphrey's room. And one thing was very striking to me as I looked up on the walls and saw the little paintings and the gilding and all this. I thought, wow, the effort gone into this just to create this impression of lavishness for the sake of highlighting how important reading books is, how important study is, how important learning is. So the buildings could just be boxes in the suburbs of Oxford and they could sell everything else, sure, but we wouldn't be signifying the importance and beauty of learning.
Yeah, so there could be a functional aspect to this, right? Sell the buildings, go and make a really nice, you know, send a train out to the suburbs for some box. But it reminds me of the Soviet era architecture in not only Russia, but lots of parts of Eastern Europe where you had these huge, awful buildings that were incredibly functional, but in the end ended up being soul-crushing environments for people. There's a whole lot about this sort of discussion that goes somewhere towards what's really key about being human.
It's a beautiful picture of balance, I suppose, balanced human life. Well, there are some of our reflections on this huge tangle of questions about altruism, luxury, culture, giving, utilitarianism, beauty and human nature, among other things. There's so much more to be said, but we hope you've enjoyed the discussion and we'll continue the conversation yourself. Next week on Life and Faith, we're speaking to Advocate for Women and Girls, Melinda Tankard-Reist, about her new book, Prostitution Narratives, which takes on some of the sex industry's myths about women, sex work, violence and trauma. Join us then.